Hi, I'm Joy Manning, editor of Edible Philly.
And I'm Marisa McClellan, author of Food in Jars.
Welcome to Local Mouthful. We're here to talk about living the food life in Philadelphia and beyond. This week, we're talking about things that can derail dinner, my own experience living without alcohol for 5 months, and Joan Nathan's new book, King Solomon's Table. But first, let's compare notes on something we read this week.
There's a restaurant in Pittsburgh on the other side of the state here that's having something of a controversy about having served horse meat. Now, here in the U.S., we don't really think of horses as being
food,
but in other parts of the world, it is. And
in case we have any Pittsburgh folks listening, the restaurant is Cure. The chef is Justin Severino, and he was doing a collaboration dinner with Toronto-based eateries called one is called Beast, the other is Home of the Brave. And apparently this horse is a traditional French-Canadian ingredient.
And so they were, it was a very themed dinner. And so they had horse tartare on the menu, and there has been quite the uproar. And it's really interesting because one of the issues it raises is simply how we decide whether something is food or not. And, you know, here in the U.S., horse is not food, according to our sort of, you know, norms and standards. But in other parts of the world, it very solidly is. And I think it's an interesting topic to talk about.
Yes. First of all, I sort of want to give a hat tip to Emily Teal, editor of Spoonful Magazine and friend of the show. And we were talking about this yesterday, and she brought this really interesting piece to our attention. And she told us, she gave us some interesting global context on this when she mentioned her travels to Italy and how was she in Parma? I can't remember what region she said she was in. But apparently there's a type of pesto there that's made with raw horse meat.
Yeah. And she was saying that she thought she was ordering pesto and would get a basil pesto. But unless you specify pesto Genovese, you get ground horse meat.
Hmm. Well, so Italy is team horse meat.
Yeah. One of the interesting, the other thing was, I think it was Emily saying this as well, was that one of the primary reasons that horse meat is banned in the U.S. is not because of our sort of ideas and norms, but because horses often get so much medication.
Right.
And
that to me is a good reason.
Yeah, that is definitely a good reason. So essentially, because horses aren't being raised for food in the U.S., they aren't, the amount of medication and sort of chemicals that are given to them is not regulated for food intake.
I suspect, though, that was not the protesters' problem.
Probably.
Who took to, you know, a petition to get the governor to speak out against it. And it made me think of what happened when Whole Foods began selling rabbit.
Yeah.
There was a lot of animal activists and, I guess, pet rabbit owners that were not happy that Whole Foods had decided to sell, Peter Rabbit at the meat counter. But the fact is that rabbits that are grown for food are, you know, a very environmentally friendly product, high in protein, low in fat, quite delicious.
Yeah.
So I don't really understand the fervor around that kind of stuff.
It's all kind of what we know and what we expect. You know, on the topic of rabbit, it's interesting. When I was a kid, we had neighbors across the street who raised rabbits for meat and for fur and would often give my mom some rabbit, but my mom would never tell us that what we were eating was rabbit. She'd make like soup or stew with it.
It does taste like chicken
and
a bit.
She would tell us it was chicken. So I've eaten rabbit many times in my life thinking it was chicken.
It did make me, you know, I eat no processed foods pretty much. And
yeah.
I know that that's also the case for you. And sometimes people say to me, oh, how do you resist the temptation for McDonald's or like Oreos or whatever? And the fact is, it doesn't seem like resisting temptation at all to me because that stuff is not food to me.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I'm not good at resisting temptation. Like a McDonald's hamburger does not register as food to me. I'm sure it would if I was starving to death or whatever.
Yeah.
But that's sort of like, I can relate to the mindset in that way.
I can see that. Just to clarify, too, the horse tartare that they served at this restaurant was from a reputable horse farm in Canada. So it's not like they were
jacked up on horse steroids.
Yeah,
or whatever.
Exactly. But then that raises another issue of cross-border transportation of meat. And so there were, you know, multiple issues at play here. But, you know, we're curious, you know, do you see horses as something that is exempt from the food chain? You know, do we, as humans, that's just not something we eat? Or, you know, what's your view? You know, leave us a comment on the website. We'd love to hear it.
All right, let's talk about dinner.
Yeah, please.
We decided to call our What's for Dinner segment this week Dinner Derailed.
Yeah.
Because I, for one, have been having a very difficult time getting on track with meal planning, which all last year I was really killing it.
Yeah.
Updating my Google Calendar, making new recipes from cookbooks every week, shaming you on the podcast for not for not keeping track, sharing my list with everyone who listens to the show. And this year, whether it's because of my move or whatever, but I have been off my game. As I mentioned to you before the show even started today, I don't even know what I'm having for dinner tonight. This is not like... Not like me.
I definitely think your move is a big part of it, Joy, because, you know, you were without kitchen, your kitchen was packed up. So, you know, at least now you're better situated to cook more. But
somewhat. I mean, definitely, definitely.
Yeah.
But I still am having frustrations with the kitchen thanks to our cabinets not having doors. Our island doesn't have a countertop surface yet. Our pantries are not built, which is actually kind of a big problem because if you don't have places to store things, you never know where anything is. You know, we both just celebrated our birthdays, and my mother had a little family dinner for me last weekend, and Dan made his chocolate sour cream bundt cake, and he had to make it twice because the first time he made it, he left out the baking soda.
Oh, no.
Now, you know Dan. This is not like Dan.
He's no. Never, and,
but it's because, like, every single ingredient for the cake was like a treasure hunt, you know? Uh-huh. And that really, that you don't need that level of distraction when you're baking or cooking. It leads to mistakes, so... It's been a little frustrating. And even though, yes, I can cook in my kitchen now, it's still frustrating.
It's imperfect. And I get that. But I mean, it's hard. And it's interesting how I feel like cooking dinner is much like an exercise habit that you can get into it and maintain it. But as soon as something comes along and like bumps you out of your track, out of the sort of nice, comfy groove you've created for yourself, it's so hard.
The other issue is we have, Dan wanted to do a lot of the stuff in the kitchen himself, and we have we bought a hood, a rain, like a vent. What do you call it? I think it's a hood.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that you use if you're going to like get a cast iron skillet to 1,000,000 degrees and like sear the heck out of a steak, right? So it's not working. We need an electrician to come look at it. So like there's a whole lot of stuff that it's normally part of the rotation that I don't want to make because I don't have that, like steak, hamburgers, anything that would be like fried or like create a bunch of stuff in the kitchen that you want to vent out of there. Sorry.
No, it's fine.
Needing to cry about those things.
Or you could do what I do because I don't have a hood in my kitchen, and that's get a box fan that you put in the window or a door and blow all of the smoke out.
Design flaw in my kitchen. I can't reach the windows.
Oh no!
I have to like get on a step stool and sit on the counter to open them.
Oh no, that is a design flaw. Well, I mean, for me lately, the thing that's been derailing my best dinner intentions has been, I don't know, simply that the weather's been nice. It's been harder to be like, on track to cook because it's like, oh, the weather's nice. Let's go for a walk. And then it's 7 o'clock and Scott and I are both hungry. And, you know, living where we live, there's so many options. So like sweet green is a really, you know, makes a good salad, pretty healthy. It's down the street.
True. I would love to have that in my neighborhood.
But
sweet
green,
if you're listening.
But the only issue is then it costs $25 for the two of us for dinner. And I could make a salad for us for six.
Yep.
And so then that becomes, you know, blows the dinner budget. Even if it's healthy, it becomes really expensive really fast. So I think we're both a little off track and it's time to get back on the dinner planning bandwagon.
Oh, there's another thing causing me trouble. We're going to go over.
We've talked about this before.
It's
all right. Go
for it. We're going to go over on this segment. I hate Whole Foods. What is happening to my Whole Foods? My Whole Foods South Street, my beloved supermarket for 15 years, is like having an identity crisis. It thinks it's a cafe. I mean, like, you know how you go into Old Navy and there's like the single fed line to the cashier, and there's like most of the cashiers now are like it's an Old Navy. Like, there's not even a belt because the assumption is you're coming in for like one boxed salad or like whatever the heck people are, you know, Amy's frozen pizza. And it's stressing me out to go there because every time I go, there's fewer real ingredients. I texted you from the supermarket last time I went there because they were selling a single tiny fermented pickle in a pouch for $2.99. So that to me, I don't want to go to Whole Foods. And that has been a big problem as well.
Yeah. If you're not doing your grocery shopping, it's not
You do not shop there every week, right? Or ever, really?
No, I hardly ever go to the Whole Foods on South Street. I go to the one, the brand new Giant one. And even though it's Giant, at least there's a lot of ingredients there, especially if you shop sort of the perimeter of the store. There's a lot of actual food and good ingredients.
I find that super overwhelming. I've only been one time.
The other thing you mentioned is that perhaps it's because you have gone booze-free this year.
Yes. Another thing that is happening to me is...
And just to note, this is our next topic. So.
Right. I quit drinking in January, and now here we are at the end of May, and I'm still not drinking, and I don't think I'm going to drink anymore because I really enjoy the experience of never being hungover and never being buzzed or drunk or dehydrated. Well, it's not that I'm never dehydrated, but I just feel so incredibly much better. It's like, I think it's going to stick. And even though it's only been 5 months, there have been a lot of times in the past when I have stopped drinking for like a month or so. And I always knew, I feel like I was like warming up for years to make this change.
Yeah.
Now it feels like a breakthrough. And in fact, if you want to like follow along with my adventures and not drinking, I started a new Instagram account just for that purpose. It's Better Without Booze. That's the handle, Better Without Booze. And I chose that because everything seems to me better without booze. Work, my relationships with other people, my sleep is really primo. But I have been, it seems like it doesn't make sense on the surface, but I've been going out a lot because I used to not go out to a thing if I thought there was any chance I might have more than two glasses of wine because I didn't want to feel terrible.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there were lots of things that I would just not go to if I didn't want to drink there. Like, it never crossed my mind that I could go to something and not drink.
I get that.
But now I know, like, for example, recently, with a couple of our mutual foodie friends, I went to a multi-course chef's thing. And there was a beer pairing, and normally I would think, oh, I don't really need a beer pairing on a Sunday night. But now I knew I wasn't going to have the beer pairing, so I just went, and it was great. You know, we were at a media dinner last night, which we'll talk about. And again, that's something that I might have passed on for not wanting to drink on a whatever night that was. And I really believe I had more fun without alcohol. I mean, there were four of us, two of us drank, two of us didn't. I didn't feel weird. Like, and then there's the non-alcoholic beverages, which will need to be its own segment at another time. But there is a world of non-alcoholic beverages out there. I think the non-alcoholic craft beverage sector is about to sort of pop. And then, of course, there's homemade non-alcoholic beverages. Like, I learned how to make shrubs from you, which we've discussed on this show.
We have. I've been into making like a rhubarb ginger honey. I'm calling it a cordial.
Oh, right. That's so tasty, too.
It's so good.
And as I mentioned to you, I bought myself a pretty fancy birthday present.
Big old juicer.
I got the Cadillac of juicers, and it's going to be delivered soon, and I can't wait to start making fresh punches and all that good stuff. So, if you guys have had the experience transitioning away from alcohol in your life, I'd love to hear your thoughts in the comment, and I would love to connect with you on Instagram. It's Better Without Booze. See you there.
All right. So let's shift to, so we went to this dinner last night at Abe Fisher here in Philadelphia. And it was a dinner celebrating Joan Nathan's new book, King Solomon's Table. And Joan Nathan, if you don't know who she is a phenomenal cookbook author who focuses primarily on Jewish food and food in the diaspora. And her latest book, King Solomon's Table, is really amazing. One of the things, so it's, the subtitle is A Culinary Exploration of Jewish Cooking from Around the World. So it's not just the American Kugel. Interpretation. Yeah, it's not just Kugel.
Or hummus.
Yeah, it's a whole variety of things. And it's really a lovely book. And one of the things that makes it so wonderful is simply that it is encapsulating, or I don't know, wrapping its arms around is a better way to put it, her experience with food over a lifetime. And the head notes are really lengthy and juicy and tell little stories. And it's rare for an author to have that kind of privilege to get to spend so much time in a head note.
She's really as much a food historian as she is a recipe writer. She spoke at a panel at the National Museum of Jewish History here in Philadelphia. And I one thing she said at that talk stuck with me, which is that most cuisines are rooted in a place, but Jewish cuisine is not place rooted because Jews have lived everywhere around the world and taken their food traditions and culture everywhere they've been, and yeah. then it has interacted with the place to create really a spectacular array of dishes. She talked about being in South America and how people make latkes. Jews in South America make latkes with yucca.
Makes sense.
And like a cilantro cream.
Oh my God, that sounds so good.
It does sound good. she's just like I have been saying that she's the Julia Child of Jewish food, I guess. To sort of underscore her importance for those who don't know.
I definitely think that that's true. And so this dinner we had was really delightful and amazing, in part because it was grounded in her food, but sort of went and explored beyond what was in the book.
It was a collaboration between her point of view and her recipes and did we mention it was at Abe Fisher yeah. here in Philadelphia, who it's actually a perfect fit for the book.
Oh, totally.
Abe Fisher's mission is to explore the foods of the Jewish diaspora in a contemporary way.
Yeah.
And so it was a perfect mesh. And it was fun to see that the chef, Yehuda Seichel, is very young. And, Joan is definitely, I don't know, do you think she's in her 70s?
Probably. Late 60s. In case she's listening, let's call her in her, mid to late 60s.
And, she's vivacious. Like, she has more energy than me. She told us she was going to eat a second dinner after the dinner we were at broke up at, like, 10 p.m. last night. So definitely there's a youthful energy about her. But she has been – she took her first research trip to Israel before I was even born. And yeah. I just turned 40, so
– yeah.
At any rate, it was a fun – I thought it was a fun collaboration.
It was really fun. And I, as someone who loves to be sort of delighted by familiar things presented in unfamiliar ways, I was really tickled by the experience of the food. And one of the things that Joy, I think, knows that I'm about to talk about this, that I was so excited. So fried pickles, so here I am, someone who writes about canning and preserving. Pickles are smack dab in my wheelhouse. Pickles are my thing. I know fried pickles are an experience we've all had at like a bar. You get a fried pickle slice, a cucumber pickle slice. So one of the things we had last night was gravlax with pickled red onions that were like lightly pickled, briefly pickled, and then tempura fried. And they were so wonderful. There was just something so fun about being surprised by a familiar thing. And it was just delicious.
Yeah, the first several courses were all amazing cured fish dishes.
Yeah.
And that was one of my favorite. There was a lot of parts and a lot of parts that I loved, but those fried onion rings were just really, to me, a perfect complement to the salmon and the mustardy sauce. And then, what was it? Mackerel that
pickled
we had?
Pickled mackerel.
Pickled mackerel with like it was almost like a creme fraiche or a sour cream.
Yeah, it must have been like a creme fraiche on a really sort of sturdy, round, rye, wasn't even toast. It was just sturdy.
Crusty.
Yeah, crusty, sturdy bread.
And it had these bright shards of, I think, carrot pickle.
Pickled carrots. Yeah, Oof. That was good. That was really good.
Yeah, my mouth is totally watering thinking about that. Oh, and then, of course, there was the bluefish cake.
Yeah, the bluefish cake was really delicious. And I even liked, as sort of just the very little, amuse, they served these, I think it was like a rye caraway hummantaschen.
Oh, right.
Filled with fig, perhaps?
It was prune.
Prune.
And olives.
And olives. And then topped with a little bit of...
I think it was blue cheese.
Blue cheese. And I love that combination of sort of like earthy and sweet and savory.
Me too.
It was a little... It was perhaps a little on the sweet side, or like the filling wasn't totally perfectly balanced.
I think it depends on what you're thinking of it as. If you're thinking of it as like an amuse, like an appetizer, yeah. then it was kind of on the sweet side. But if you're thinking of it as a cookie, it was kind of on the savory
True.
Side.
True. But it's... again, as someone who's always looking for interesting ways to use up preserves and incorporate them into meals, I've had a thumbprint, like a blue cheese shortbread thumbprint filled with a fig jam before, but I hadn't thought about taking a hummantaschen and taking it in that same direction. And so it was really it was an exciting meal for me, simply in making me think about things that are familiar to me and ideas and concepts, and kind of pushing the edges of them out a little bit. And I loved it. Like, there was every, you know, I sometimes complain about restaurant meals and being really annoyed about paying for food that I could do better at my own home. This was not that meal.
I feel like that would never be the case at Abe Fisher.
No, every time I've gone to Abe Fisher, I've been really delighted by it. And it reminds me of how useful restaurant meals are in the life of a home cook.
Or a
recipe developer, that they really can inspire you and excite you and make you feel refreshed about food. And that's what I took away from that meal. And I'm excited to explore Joan's book more, because I feel like it's going to do the same thing for me that meal did last night.
Well, let's talk about the soup.
The soup.
First, in context, it was unseasonably warm yesterday, 90 degrees. So halfway through this dinner, after all these aforementioned fish dishes, I was starting to feel a bit full.
Uh-huh.
And they put down in front of us a pretty good sized bowl of what they called Russian minestrone. And what do you remember what Joan calls it in her book?
It's something similar.
It has a different name. We'll put it in the show notes. Anyway.
It's hearty Russian minestrone with green peas, zucchini, and dill in
just
the book.
To paint a picture, it was sludgy looking. It was a little heavy looking because it had the green peas. Are they split peas?
Yeah,
or
they
something?
Were split peas.
It was very.
It was not
starchy.
It didn't look thick. A clear, you know, it was not like a light soup. It looked like something you would eat with a big hunk of bread and call it lunch or dinner.
But when we dug into it, it had perfectly cooked split peas.
Yeah.
It was based on a house-made stock from Abe Fisher that was umami for miles. And then it had pretty good-sized pieces of vegetables that tasted like they were just blanched.
Yeah.
So it was smooth. Well, it wasn't smooth, but it was mushy and crunchy and savory. And I could not believe it, but I ate the whole bowl.
Oh, it was so good. And the zucchini, it was baby zucchini that was cut in half. And they were crisp, tender crisps. So you'd bite in and they would yield, but they weren't mushy. There were big pieces of carrots. And then there was some sweet potato.
Oh, right.
And then really big, but not starchy peas. The whole experience of it, you would look at it and think, really? And it was so good.
I asked the manager there if I could buy a quart to take home. He said no. But I'm definitely going to make the recipe.
It was really delicious.
And let's just touch on the chicken dish real quick. It was a delicious roast chicken with a blood sausage mixture put under the skin.
Yeah.
And delicious potatoes. And of course, your favorite and mine.
Cabbage.
Braised cabbage.
Oh, so good.
I would only wish I would have had more room to eat more of it.
Well, after that bowl of soup, it was a bit really? I could be done now.
It was so good. So delicious. And it does make me really excited. We're going to link to the book on the show notes, and I hope that you will check it out too.
Yeah. So at the market, we're going to talk a little bit about, I guess it's on the same sort of theme.
Yeah, this came up last night too, because there was no hummus that was part of the dinner, but we were talking about hummus.
Definitely. So I made a batch of hummus recently, and I used – instead, I cooked my chickpeas from scratch, but what I used was Maureen Aboud's par-cooked and dried peeled chickpeas.
Who is Maureen Aboud, for those who don't know?
She is a cookbook author, recipe developer. I think she lives in Michigan, I want to say. She might be in the Detroit area. She cooks a lot of Lebanese food. That's her familial background. And so she makes a lot of hummus. And she wrote a really beautiful book, Rosewater, and I'm blanking on it. We'll link to it. But she sells these par-cooked peeled chickpeas for easy, super smooth home hummus making.
But they're dried when you get them, right?
So they come in a bag. They're dried, but they've been par-cooked and peeled. So they're super creamy, and they only take a couple of hours to cook. And so they make the most perfect hummus. It is silky and delicious.
Where do you buy them?
You can buy them on her website.
So she has found a source for them somewhere?
I think she imports them from Lebanon.
Wow.
And so she also sells it as a kit. You can buy it with her favorite tahini and a little jar of sumac so that you're ready to go. You can just buy the chickpeas. She's got a variety of things on her website. But I love these chickpeas.
I think it was perhaps on Deb Perlman's Smitten Kitchen site where I first read about the insane idea of peeling your chickpeas for hummus. And I maybe did it one time and it did produce a good result, but I was like, this is for crazy people.
I have done it myself. I have stood there over the sink and peeled like a can. If I was just making a quick batch, where I'll rub the skins off a can.
That's not a quick batch anymore, though.
True.
Yeah. You know I'm a huge devotee of the recipe in the Zahav book.
I know.
Where you soak the dried chickpeas in baking soda and then you cook them in baking soda, which in and of itself softens the skin a lot. And a lot of them come off when you're like...
Yeah.
That's and I think the result is a very silky smooth hummus, but I might be interested in trying. I'm intrigued by these.
You should order a bag of them. I mean, they're more expensive than regular dried chickpeas, but
ultimately we're still talking about chickpeas.
Yeah. As my grandfather would have said, what are you, bubkis, which is chickpeas in Yiddish.
That's funny.
And it was an indication.
I didn't know that.
Oh, you didn't know that? Yeah. And so it was thought of as like the cheap food.
Right.
I'm nothing, but.
A delicious food, though. A
delicious food. But anyway.
Did you have to pay shipping? I bet you did.
Yes.
Yeah, that can be a.
But if you have struggled with homemade hummus and you really want to have success with it, mm-hmm. there are a really good path towards that.
Right.
And it definitely shows you the difference between a hummus made with, you know, a high quality peeled chickpea versus, you know, just a can.
Well, I mean,
yeah,
I don't believe in making hummus with canned chickpeas. I don't believe in that. It goes against my grain.
Fair enough.
Well,
yeah. But anyway, it's delicious hummus. And you should make hummus at home. And that's it for this week's installment of Local Mouthful. Our thanks go out to Dan Call for editing the show, to Saul Rosenbaum for designing our logo, and to Raina Rose for providing the music. And thank you for listening. If you like what you hear, make sure to subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Local Mouthful. You can sign up for our newsletter, catch up on past episodes, and check out our show notes on localmouthful.com. Until next time, happy eating.